Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist here with you today to talk a little bit about survival of the fittest and social Darwinism. Pick up where we left off last week. In the last podcast, I talked about Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection, which turned out to be based on something as mundane as reproduction. All right, sex, so maybe it's not that mundane, but still, sex is not the point, it's reproduction, that's the point. Through the sheer luck of genetics, some individuals have characteristics that help them to reproduce in a particular environment, while others have disadvantages that keep them from reproducing. Those with genetic advantages will be able to reproduce and pass on those traits to their offspring, while those with disadvantages won't. So generation by generation, these advantages accumulate in the offspring until eventually they're no longer precisely the same animals as their ancestors were, and we can say that evolution has occurred. The species has evolved. The theory of natural selection wasn't quite as shocking or heretical at the time as you may have thought it was. It didn't challenge God or the church at all, and it was widely accepted even by scientists as an expression of divine will. Remember, nature at the time was pretty much synonymous with God. And as I explained in the last podcast, artificial selection was very well understood long before Darwin, from all the breeding that we had done of plants and animals, so natural selection made perfect sense. Today, though, I want to talk about the consequences of Darwin's theory in society, the way it was understood by the public at large, or rather the way it's been misunderstood. So let's assume you never listened to my last podcast, and I asked you to tell me, what's the theory of evolution? You'd say, survival of the fittest, right? No doubt in my mind, survival of the fittest, that's what you'd say. And you'd be completely wrong. You and every anthropologist who says it on the History Channel or the Discovery Channel or National Geographic or anything like that, they all say it and they're all wrong. Summing up Darwin's theory of natural selection as survival of the fittest is like saying that making a living is all about showing up to work. No, it's not. You still have to do the job. It's not only showing up that has consequences for your paycheck, it's actually getting the job done. And it's not survival that gets the evolutionary job done, it's reproduction. The emphasis is in the wrong place. There's also this idea that the fittest are somehow better than the others. Stronger, smarter, faster, something that justifies their success and makes us feel better about the whole equation. But it's just not true. From an evolutionary point of view, the fittest are simply those who have the most babies. Looking at human beings alone, I think it's safe to say that those among us who have the most children are not necessarily more fit, stronger, smarter, faster than the rest of us. And in the rest of the animal kingdom, there are countless examples of the so-called weakling getting the girl. There's a lot of luck involved here. You don't get to take credit for being somehow superior just because you've managed to reproduce. The great irony is that while many people reject the idea of evolution in biology, they believe strongly that it happens in society. I have students who believe in creationism argue passionately with me about survival of the fittest when I tell them it's wrong. They have an emotional attachment to it, despite the fact that they don't even believe in evolution. Of course they believe in survival of the fittest. They're Americans, and that phrase sums up our point of view about life in general very well. It goes to the core of our rugged, individualist, competitive spirit. It makes perfect sense. That's why it's understandable that Darwin's theory has been completely misconstrued even by scientists. It's because science doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's always a product of the times, of the culture in which it lives. Science happens in the lab or in the field, where it gets interpreted through the biases of the scientist, and then it goes out into the world where it gets reinterpreted through the biases of the culture. That's why it's important, when you study science, to also study history, cultural context. You have to know what's going on in the culture in order to understand what the scientists are doing and how the science is received. So, what was going on in our culture in America when Darwin published his work? Well, it was 1859. This was only 2 years before the start of the Civil War, which ended in 1865. So that's 6 years before America was faced with the reality of 4 million formerly enslaved human beings suddenly seeking a new niche in our economy. Seriously, that's 4 million people who are suddenly on the job market, suddenly looking for housing. That's a lot of new competition. What in the world were we going to do with all of these people? They represented something like 10 to 12% of the total population of the country. And let's be clear, formerly a great many Americans did not even consider them to be people. So just exactly how concerned do you think they were going to be for their welfare, for their employment? That's when science came in pretty handy. Because science never disagrees with a dominant culture, despite when you've been taught about people like Galileo. Yes, the church persecuted Galileo for his heresy of truth-telling, but all the learned men of his day knew that he was right. They were just smart enough to keep their mouths shut about it. Science happens strictly because the cultural circumstances make it possible, not the other way around. So if science discovers something, it's because the society was ready to go looking for it in the first place. Now, that doesn't mean the church is ready. That's only one part of society. But society at large is ready. So science came along at just the right time, just before this flood of new competitors in the job market and the housing market, came along at just the right time to tell us, hey, don't worry. The way things are, this inequality, it's the natural order of things. There are always going to be weak and strong, poor and rich, sick and healthy individuals, but nature will take care of it. You don't have to. God helps those who help themselves, right? Well, now we have science to back that up. Natural selection weeds the weak from the strong to benefit the species overall. And who are we to get in its way? Let nature take its course, and the cream will rise to the top. The strong will survive and prosper. Never mind what happens to the weak. That's natural selection. Those who are rich deserve to be rich because they're somehow superior to those who are poor. We all deserve exactly what we get. Survival of the fittest. Natural selection. God's plan. Whatever. We have, by and large, one man to thank for the phrase survival of the fittest, which is a gross misinterpretation of Darwin's work. His name is Herbert Spencer. Like Darwin, Spencer was a well-off, well-educated Englishman who was a hotshot intellectual at the time, which means only that his peers respected him, but regular people had no idea who he was. Still don't. Spencer was a writer and philosopher. He was someone people listened to at the time, and he was a man of strong opinions. He was a product of his culture, a product of his times, but he stood at the top among its most successful. Spencer took Darwin's ideas about biological evolution and applied them to society, to culture. He figured, well, as in nature, so in culture. He reasoned by analogy. He thought that if something was true of biology, of animals and plants, that it might also be true of human culture. I personally fail to see the relationship between culture and biology in an analogical sense because we are not plants. Culture is something unique about human beings. It is precisely what separates us from the other animals. It's what makes us different. Animals are subject to their environments. Human beings change their environments. That's what culture is. Culture gives us control over our environment through things like language and technology. So human beings are unique. We cannot be analyzed through the same lens as a plant or a non-human animal. Nevertheless, Spencer committed a fallacy of logic. He reasoned by analogy. He made a biological analogy to culture. He looked at Darwin's theories and thought, as in nature, so in culture. Since in the animal kingdom, species over time tend to get more complex, more sophisticated, that was his take on it anyway, he thought cultures also get more complex, more sophisticated. He thought cultures went through a series of stages of progress, wherein later cultures were more sophisticated, smarter, better than earlier cultures. It definitely involves a degree of racism and ethnocentrism that says that you are the best and you are the smartest in your way. You know better. So Spencer created social Darwinism, because he took the biological concept of evolution and applied it to culture. We call it cultural or social evolution, and that's just another way of expressing the ideas of social Darwinism. Spencer read Darwin's work and thought to himself, yes, this makes perfect sense to me. Some individuals are simply better than others, so of course they are successful. Well, that's a terrible oversimplification, but it fit perfectly with the rest of his racist philosophies about his own cultural superiority, so he believed it. Yeah, he thought, the rich are rich because they're superior, which means they deserve their wealth, and the poor are poor because they're inferior, and this is how it should be. Might makes right. Natural selection. Survival of the fittest. Well, it was easy for Spencer to think this way, because he was a 19th century Englishman, which is to say that he was a wealthy member of the upper classes of a society that had not a kingdom, but an empire at the time, and which believed itself to be the greatest and most advanced civilization in history, don't we all, with a unique responsibility, the white man's burden, to civilize and evangelize the rest of the world. So yes, it makes sense that he believed that his position was justified by his superiority. So Spencer summed up Darwin's theory as survival of the fittest. He was completely wrong, but it caught on, simple as that. It's true that Darwin did eventually use the phrase himself, but he meant something completely different from the way people use it today, because Darwin was talking about biology and reproduction, while Spencer, and most folks since, have been talking about some kind of intellectual or moral superiority. So, out in the real world, Darwin's type of science got buried under an avalanche of Spencer's type of bigotry, because bigotry, as always, was economically advantageous. It justifies the lot of the poor. It's who they are. It's in their nature. It's not your fault. It's not your problem. It also conveniently justifies the expansion of the English Empire across the so-called uncivilized world. When ideas about social Darwinism are taken to their idiot extreme, we end up with what's called eugenics. It's the notion that human beings should allow natural selection to run its course with us. We should stop interfering with our medicines and our charities and just let natural selection do its thing. In other words, if someone is sick, don't interfere. Let nature take its course. The strong will survive, go on to produce strong children, and contribute to the improvement of our species. If someone is poor or disabled, well, then they have been naturally deselected, so to speak. And if they can't pick themselves up and succeed on their own, well, then they shouldn't be helped, because that would only encourage them to reproduce and contribute their weakness to our species. Survival of the fittest will improve the human race if we only allow it to happen. Hitler brought this philosophy to its ultimate insane conclusion, which is to say that he decided not just to let nature take its course, but to help it along, speed up the process of weeding out the undesirables. He wasn't the only one, you know. Right here in America, we sterilized thousands of mentally ill and imprisoned people before we realized where it was leading us. And truth be told, that's how Hitler got started, too. He did the same thing to his own good German people before ramping up for the Holocaust. So, social Darwinism has developed an ugly reputation. As a society today, we have thankfully lost our attraction to social Darwinism and eugenics, for the most part, but we're still largely attracted to the idea of survival of the fittest, particularly in its economic context. It speaks to the competition and individualism at the heart of American culture. This is the land of every man for himself, isn't it? Where you reap what you sow, so you pick yourself up by your bootstraps because you have no one to blame but yourself. Is that enough aphorisms for you? So why are some people poor? Because they don't work hard enough, right? Well, clearly you never took a sociology class. You never learned about structural or institutional inequality or the simple fact that there is really no such thing as equality of opportunity in this country. You want another aphorism? How about, it takes money to make money? And if you have nothing to begin with, in all likelihood, well, that's what you'll end up with, too. Nope. We like to believe in the American dream. Anyone can become rich. Anyone can become president. Do you still think that? Mitt Romney has characterized America not as a land of haves and have-nots, but as a land of haves and about-to-haves. Right. That would mean we live in a delusional fantasy, because clearly there's something like 95% of us who aren't about to have anything. Survival of the fittest describes our attitude toward this perfectly. We truly believe that we must compete against each other head to head in order to succeed, and that only some of us actually will succeed. This is an economic argument, not a biological one. It has nothing to do with evolution or natural selection. It's an argument that was made early on in the United States by a man named William Graham Sumner, who was one of the great thinkers of what's referred to as the Gilded Age. I believe it was Mark Twain who came up with this expression, the Gilded Age, to refer to this period of American history, to indicate his belief that there was sort of a gold plating covering up what he felt was really a rather rusty American society in terms of the social problems at the time. During the Gilded Age of American history, the income inequality between the rich and the poor grew at a phenomenal rate, and we saw the rise of the great wealthy dynasties of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. Sumner, as a graduate of Yale, counted himself among these elites. In 1883, he published an essay entitled, What Social Classes Owe to Each Other? And his answer was, nothing. The rich owe the poor nothing. If you were someone who was sympathetic to the plight of people who were less fortunate, less healthy, less able to yourself, such that you chose to render assistance, then what you were doing was enabling the destruction and downfall of American society. A social Darwinist or a eugenicist might say that you were enabling the destruction of the race. But Sumner was more concerned with questions of economy. He also believed that the hero of Western society is the American businessman. He alone will lead us to the top, his innovation, his expertise, his talent, his drive, his motivation. The titans of industry, so to speak, were his American heroes. As such, things like taxes and regulations endanger his survival. When you endanger the survival of the American businessman, you endanger America. Does this sound at all familiar? These ideas are central to the so-called objectivist philosophy of the writer Ayn Rand, of whom folks like Paul Ryan and Ron Paul are so fond. I believe Ron Paul named his son Rand Paul after Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand was a writer. She actually tried to make it in Hollywood and turned out to be more successful with her novels. She was born to a secular Jewish family in Russia that was fairly well-to-do. I think her father was a pharmacist. And when the Bolshevik Revolution occurred, her family lost everything and they fled the country for a while until it was safe to return. She was essentially an atheist who believed in reason above all. She's known best from her two novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And Atlas Shrugged is the perfect metaphor for what I was just describing, the idea that the titans of industry will, like Atlas, hold the world upon their shoulders and that we shouldn't be throwing stones at them, kicking their heels. While her books were, shall we say, not critically successful and not particularly well-respected as literature, although it's my understanding that they do have some steam and sex scenes, they were very, very well-received for their philosophy, which has become foundational in the American Libertarian Party and in the conservative movement. Her novels are really just a platform for her political and economic point of view, which is to say that she was a great supporter of what's called laissez-faire, or free market capitalism. It's the idea that the market should be free to do whatever it thinks is best for the economy, and that a rational and informed consumer will guide its choices. It's very idealistic in practice, in my opinion, because the idea that we are rational and informed consumers is optimistic, to say the least. It's the idea that government should never give a handout because people have to take responsibility for themselves and make their own lives happen. It's a point of view held exclusively by people who don't need anything. And these are the folks who talk about America as a land of makers and takers, where you're either on the dole or working hard, never both or back and forth between the two. It's a completely polarized and oversimplified view of the world. It makes everything out to be your own fault and your own responsibility, while accusing its critics of doing exactly the opposite, letting you off the hook for everything, when the truth is obviously somewhere in between. We do have control over our own actions, but we're also at the mercy of outside forces, and some of us are just a lot luckier than others. Some of it is a blessing of birth. It would be productive, I think, to acknowledge the source of Ayn Rand's philosophy before we open our arms to it and accept it uncritically. As I said, her family suffered at the hands of the Bolsheviks, so it's easy to see that this hyper-capitalist point of view was a reaction to the hyper-socialist view of the Bolsheviks. As a child, Rand was subjected to a system which decreed that she could own nothing, that she could possess nothing, and that the fruits of her labor would never be justly rewarded. And her childish reaction to that, if you'll forgive me and allow me a bit of ridiculous pup psychology, her childish reaction to that was to say, "This is wrong. This is not the way it should be. I think that I should have some control over the circumstances of my life. My parents own a store, they worked hard for it, and they got it taken away from them, and that's just wrong." So, of course, she became a fierce advocate of free market capitalism. Get the government away. Get away from me with your rules and your regulations, and allow me to live the life that I deserve to live because I earned it. There has to be some kind of middle ground between these two points of view. There has to be some kind of rational space between the idea that the government owes you nothing and the government should have no control over you, the government should have nothing to do with your life at all, and the idea that the government should totally take care of you. There has to be some kind of rational space between these two points of view, between this hyper-capitalist free market point of view and its ultimate extreme opposite of socialism. That's just a ridiculous and unnecessary opposition. It doesn't have to be one or the other, where both things are at absolute opposite extremes. We need to find a middle ground. Well, this has been a short but intense podcast today, and we've traveled a lot of territory. We've talked about evolution and Darwin's theory of natural selection and how it was completely misinterpreted and misapplied by people like Herbert Spencer, and how Spencer's ideas went on to influence people like William Graham Sumner, who in turn influenced Ayn Rand, who is still influencing our politics today. It's just one strand of thought in American politics. I hope you've enjoyed this explanation. I hope you've enjoyed making these connections with me. I hope you'll continue to listen, tune in for further podcasts, try to do them approximately every 10 days or so. I'd love it if you would take a look at the blog on the website. I write a little more regularly on that about politics and current events. That's at www.theanonymousanthropologist.com. It'd be great if you could send me an email if you've got anything to say, to add, if you disagree with me. Love to hear about that. You can send me an email at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com, or you can give me a call at 206-312-3526. Leave me a voicemail. I'll be happy to include you on the show. It's 206-312-3526. If you have any questions about anthropology or archaeology or anything you'd like me to talk about on future episodes, I'd love to hear that. I am currently having a small issue with the Facebook page. It's still up and running, but I have lost administrator access to it, oddly enough. I think they realized that I am trying to remain anonymous, and that is apparently against their policy. So I cannot currently update it, but I can look at it and see the messages that you leave for me there. And I do have an acquaintance who is posting updates there for me, but I myself cannot gain access and do anything with it right now. So I'll have to figure out what to do about that. I am, for the moment, dedicated to trying to remain somewhat anonymous, and Facebook doesn't like that. So we'll have to work that out on a week-by-week basis, I imagine. Look forward to chatting with you in another 10 days or so. Until then, take care.
Hello, recording.